sometimes when I'm in certain frames of mind, particularly on very hot days around the North Circular, I can feel time radiating off of pre-moulded concrete lintels.
Welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography with John Rogers and Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that looks at the rich tradition of early 20th century topographical walking guides to London and the South East and what use they might be to us today.
It's a kind of like inlet valves for some unmediated cosmic energy.
Each week, we'll be taking a trip through the pages of a different book as if we are on a wayward topographical ramble.
Because I know they're actually just technology, they're applied machinery, but they seem to me almost to be kind of like storage vats of regional memory.
Hello and welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography with me, John Rogers, and my co-host, Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that explores the world of early 20th century walking guides to London and the South East, and this week we are coming to you live from the Residence Studios in Borough High Street, which is as far south as we will venture in this series, peculiarly enough. We will be covering six different books in the coming weeks. Last week we introduced you to the themes that we'll be exploring in the show, and this week we are dealing with Gordon S. Maxwell's The Fringe of London, published in 1925. Now, when we got together, Nick, to choose the books that would be part of this series, the event was rather like the Synod of Carthage, when the Gospels that would make up the Holy Bible were selected. And there was one book, the book we're covering this week, The Fringe of London by Gordon S. Maxwell, over which there was no debate at all, was there?
Not at all, John. And in fact, I remember when we were first introduced to each other after an initial episode of sniffing around each other and looking at each other suspiciously, we touched upon the subject of The Fringe of London, and we've been pretty close friends ever since. That was the thing that brought us together. That was the thing that enabled us to recognise that we had a shared interest, that there was something strong and powerful that we had between us.
That's very true indeed. And it was a deeply romantic occasion. We were almost set up on a blind date by a mutual friend who had spotted that we both had a passion for this obscure topographical walking book. I say it is obscure, but hopefully by the end of the show you will have joined us in venerating this holy tome. I'd like to now quickly play a very short reading from the introduction to The Fringe of London.
Chapter 1. Ventures and Adventures in Topography. The borderline between folklore and fairy tales is not more nebulous than that between topographical research and nosing about. The former, in either case, is but a grander name for practically the same thing. I mean the outdoor part of topography, not the many hunts in the land of books that usually follows later. To confess to the study of folklore and topography is to be thought somewhat of a savant, but to own that you like fairy tales and exploring old buildings, or anywhere fancy may lead you, is to risk being considered of rather peculiar tastes by some people. Yet I challenge anyone to prove a distinct dividing line between the two things.
Now, that reading beautifully illustrates the reason I fell in love with this book. When I peered through the window of Amwell Books on Amwell Street in Islington and saw it in a glass case, and I was doing some research into the area around High Wycombe at the time, and I thought, there's going to be a chapter about High Wycombe in that book. And I went into the shop. The lady removed it from the cupboard. I would like to say that she had little white gloves on, but she didn't. And she opened the book. And the first picture inside the book is an etching by Donald S. Maxwell, Gordon S. Maxwell's brother, of the hills around High Wycombe. And I read those two paragraphs and I thought, this book's for me.
My experience was rather similar, John. I'd been walking for a while when I discovered this book in about 10 years ago. I think it was about mid-1999. And I pulled it out of, I think it was a dusty old shelf in 2J's bookshop in Edgware. Had a look at it, opened it up, and found, in fact, the chapter that we'll be looking at today, the chapter on Monk's Park, which is down near Stonebridge Park in Wembley. And I was astonished that somebody had thought to write about such a place, because for me, the suburbs and my own general region were still, I'm sad to say, at that late date, invisible to me in a curious sort of way. And what Gordon S. Maxwell and his brother Donald, with his illustrations, enabled me to do was to reapproach my own region with greater consciousness.
Yes, interesting, because I think the chapters in the book, which we'll do a little run through some of the areas in the book in just a mo, but in terms of how Maxwell deals with the subject matter, he certainly deals with the areas around Wembley, and your beat, Nick, is Middlesex. You are, in fact, the author of MiddlesexCountyCouncil.org.uk, which is not a local authority website, despite the fact that it was recently pulled out as one of the worst examples of local authority websites in a government poll. It deals with the sort of the areas closest to London best, because the chapter on High Wycombe, or the hills near High Wycombe, which is a wonderful chapter, where he is called a Meeting with the Last Minstrel, where he describes coming across one of the last sort of travelling balladeers who would earn his keep by singing old ballads to people, which is I suspected, actually, that Maxwell had made that up, because that's the way it reads. I mentioned it to my father, who was an old Chilterns man himself, and he had a similar encounter with a travelling ballad singer who had told a similar story to the one that Maxwell tells in the book, where the old ballad singers are no longer welcome singing in pubs and they get ushered out of the door. Nick, do you want to just quickly say something about the other chapters in the book, some of the areas that this book covers around the fringe of London?
Certainly, John. The book focuses very much on Middlesex. It has a chapter on the track of John Gilpin through Edmonton.
It's a good chapter, that one.
That is very interesting. And also, there's a very interesting chapter about a murder that took place in Radlett in...
Oxfordshire, is it?
No, that's in Hertfordshire. Uh-huh. In 1834, if I remember rightly. That was a murder that influenced English literature. And there's also a very good essay on Kenwood, which had just recently at that time been opened up to the public.
And he does have a slightly... considering these books are walking guides, that's how they're sold, the ramble book, and which is a term Maxwell uses himself, and I don't think I've come across it in any other so-called ramble books. We'll play an interview that we just conducted before coming on air with Professor Kristin Blumel, who's studied the ramble book. And Maxwell by no means approaches his area of study with an academic eye. He's quite poetic and romantic, and the chapter about the sign of the widow's son, a pub near Bow Church, is a great example, because he describes being in this pub somewhere near Mo. I think I get the impression it's Mile End, actually, and that an old man comes in as he's admiring this kind of peculiar thing hanging from the ceiling, this sort of, like, he describes it as being like a very large bunch of black grapes, and he has a conversation with this man who tells him that it's for him, and that the story then Maxwell recounts is that it's the mother of a sailor who was lost at sea, and she kept the pub, and every year, and she expected him back for Easter, and every year at Easter she saved him a hot cross bun and kept it for him for each of her 85 years, I think. Actually, that's impossible, isn't it? But anyway, Maxwell, I think, says each of her 85 years, and I believe him. He is our prophet. And so he, in this topographical walking guide, he has a conversation with a ghost. Nick's got speechless. He's rendered speechless, but I think I've offended.
I've turned white.
Nick's seen the same ghost. In fact, he may be the same ghost. I'm just going to quickly now play another quick reading from the introduction to The Fringe of London. The introduction to this book sort of sets out an ethos, I think, which is something that I certainly latched onto, and I sort of feel that Nick, you're a kindred spirit, obviously, in this pursuit as well. We'll play this little clip, and then we'll talk about what we think this represents in terms of a sort of topographical tradition.
The Fringe of London is best explored on foot. It may take longer, but it is the only way to do it thoroughly. The motorist misses most. He may see the church or the local inn, the latter he may often enter, but he usually leaves unvisited most other points of interest that are not stock places. The thrills of trespass, its dangers and rewards, are not for him. It is a conventional thing to say in a ramble book that you are writing of places off the beaten track. In this book, save in one or two cases, I am not doing anything of the kind. I am writing of places on the beaten track, and for that reason, often a good deal less known to the general public than the other places. It is the old story of the prophet in his own country, translated into bricks and mortar.
So I think that is a great example of Maxwell's ethos, Nick, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing that shifts the mind out of its habitual thinking more than approaching something that you're generally habitual about with an eye towards opening it up and seeing what's hidden behind it. I've done a lot of walking in my time, and I've actually walked from Stonehenge to my front door in Child's Hill. Very moving stuff, walking out of my front door up the Hendon Way and out to Luton, etc., etc. But some of my best experiences have been reapproaching places that I grew up in and that I've walked past all my life. The last few years, the Barnet, the Hendon Way, within half a mile of where I live, has taken on a positively Blakean aspect because I've learnt a little bit about its local history, but I've also begun to think of it as something that is worthy of study rather than something that's not worth considering. And, you know, one of the things that I find around walking that I think Maxwell picks up on as well is that he talks about going on walks and then reading about the place after you visited. And I find very much that what works for me is that knowing can open up, and knowing something about an environment can open it up for you. But there's also a very strong and central place for not knowing something about a place. And there's a kind of process, a sort of solve et coagula, whereby you take on knowledge of a place, go to a place, see something new, come back, and the knowledge just keeps on growing. The body of awareness of the place that you're interacting with keeps on growing stronger.
It's interesting that process that Maxwell sets out there in 1925, because it is a debate I've had with fellow, call this what you will, psychogeographers. Maxwell introduces the term, yeah, you hate psychogeography, don't you? We talked about this last week. The podcast of that show is available online now on the Resonance website if you want to hear Nick disparaging the whole practice and study of psychogeography.
It's not true.
But Maxwell, you know, introduces the idea of topographical rambling, and he talks about the way of the topographical rambler, the ways to embark upon a topographical ramble, the rules for a topographical ramble, which I, at the time I read it, I was reading a lot sort of about situationism and psychogeography, and I equated that with what Guy Debord was saying in a much more sort of earnest, po-faced, Gallic way 30 years later. We took a walk out to Monk's Park the other Sunday, on a wet and windy Sunday. But before we play some of the excerpts that we recorded that day, I should say recorded quite shabbily. So you don't necessarily need to readjust your radios. If there's a bit of crackling, that's the sound of the River Brent. But beforehand, I'd like to play another bit of the reading of the chapter where Maxwell describes his first visit to Monk's Park. And here it is coming
Chapter
up.
11. Rural England, 4 miles from the Marble Arch. When I read in the paper recently that there was a place called Monk's Park, only 4 miles from the Marble Arch, whose inhabitants were grumbling that their last post went at 5:30 p.m. because the post office counted them a rural district, I determined one evening to explore this unknown region. I started with an open mind, prepared to find anything. Had I discovered Monk's Park to be a group of squalid cottages in some forgotten corner among factories and brickfields, or a place so rural that one might meet smock frocks, milkmaids, lowing herds, and all the conventional countrified things, I should not have been surprised. I was even prepared, if names mean anything, to find some ancient ruins still speaking of monastic peace. I saw none of these things, but what I did see not only surprised, but pleased me. In a sense, I came to scoff, but I remained to pray. Monk's Park I found to be a small community of houses amidst the fields on the road to Harrow. And the first thing that caught my eye was the tiny rural letterbox fastened to a wooden post. It is this letterbox which was causing the villagers so much distress, though this has since been relieved by a new letterbox and a later post. The main street in Monk's Park is picturesque and restful.
That bit of meadowland that he describes there with purple loosestrife and elm and oak and...
Yes, well, just along about 100 metres over in that direction, there's a line of houses. The street is called Monk's Park, and I think it's the old... on the site of, and perhaps even some of the houses actually originate from, the original Monk's Park hamlet that Maxwell describes.
Do you think that's going to have a look?
Brent's very large here, isn't it? Here it is, Monk's Park.
Not actually very difficult to find now, is it? Because it's written everywhere. Monk's Park Primary Care Centre, an enormous stainless steel lettering.
All right.
Oh, you're right, it's just called Monk's Park, and the postcode is HA9. And what are we in? We're in the London borough of...
Brent. But the point I'm trying to make, John, is that, you know, you could grow up and live in London all your life, like I have, and unless you explore, and the exploration byways is an ongoing process, there's these kind of event horizons where just beyond the place next to the place that you know, there's a completely undiscovered land. So, yeah, you know, if you come from round here, you'd know where Monk's Park is. Excuse me, sir, where's Monk's Park? Just down the road. But me, 2 miles away in Golders Green, reading Maxwell, I had to trace this through an A to Z, and then I had to visit a place that, although it's obviously familiar to me because it's a London suburb, is also completely peculiar, partly because something that's ostensibly so familiar is actually so distant psychologically.
That was a recording that we made on a walk out to Monk's Park, the other wet and windy Sunday. It was quite an experience, Nick, wasn't it? I think we found it enlightening. What were your observations, very briefly?
Well, apart from it being wet and cold, it was nice to return there. I originally visited Monk's Park about 10 years ago, after I first obtained a copy of The Fringe of London, and on that occasion, this time, I must say for the listener, Monk's Park is a street of houses that at the time Fringe of London was written was actually, according to Maxwell, a rural hamlet. And it runs eastwards from the Harrow Road, just north of Stonebridge Park. It's now been absorbed into suburbia. Reading Maxwell 10 years ago, I decided to go in search of the place, and I made the mistake of getting off at Neasden and following the Brent through to Monk's Park. Unfortunately, the Metropolitan Railway got in the way, and I had to follow the Brent through a tunnel with water up to my knees in order to make my way to Monk's Park. That was quite an experience, and it was on that occasion that I actually lost my first copy of The Fringe of London, which tumbled out of my pocket into the swirling waters.
It was reclaimed by the River Brent, and here's another little excerpt of when we first stumble upon the street of Monk's Park, and this is our moment of revelation, of divine revelation, to carry on the holy theme that we've introduced into this show, and I think we should just keep it up for the sake of it, maybe. So here's another field recording from that marvellous trip.
Ah. Doesn't look that different, does it? We're looking at a picture drawn by Gordon S. Maxwell's brother, Donald Maxwell, in The Fringe of London on page 159, a corner of the village, in inverted commas, Monk's Park. And what we're looking at is
picture of the winding River Brent with some a row of houses in the background, and I'm pretty sure that they're the houses we're looking at now. What do you reckon, John?
I think they definitely could be. They look like interwar houses. Seem to be in the same relationship to the bends of the river that they are in that drawing. This could well be it. So go on, Nick, you were going to say something about when Maxwell came here.
When Maxwell visited, these houses must have been just only slightly over 10 years old. So although he sort of depicts what one could mistake as being a rural community, in fact, although there were fields and meadows down by the winding Brent, the houses would have been very recent.
There we were in Monk's Park. Now, just before we came on air today, we rang Professor Christine Bluemill, as we mentioned earlier on the show, who has studied the Ramble book in the context of how the suburbs were perceived in the interwar years, something which is being referred to as intermodern London. And here is that phone call with Professor Bluemill.
Hello, Professor Bluemill. This is John Rogers here.
Hi, John Rogers. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for taking the time and trouble to talk to us today.
Oh, it'll be my pleasure.
Excellent. I'll just introduce my co-host here, Mr. Nick Papadimitriou. Would you like to say hello, Nick?
Hello, Professor Bluemill. John and I were both intrigued by the essay, Suburbs Are Not As So Bad, I think, that you published on the Iowa Cultural Studies online magazine.
Nick's lost outside Middlesex. He struggles with place names even in central London. There, that's why he struggled with Iowa, I think.
I guess they have suburbs in Iowa. But, it was a publication in the Iowa Journal of Cultural Studies that I did years ago. And it was so much fun to write about because, in part, I discovered the work of people like Gordon S. Maxwell.
That's good. Well, that was really one of the principal things we wanted to talk to you about, because we're just over the moon to be speaking to another person that's heard of this book, because when we discovered it, we couldn't find anybody else that knew about this book at all. We asked all sorts of the sort of usual London luminaries who you would expect to know this book, and none of them did. So when we read about it in a learned journal, we were mightily chuffed. Could you tell us a little bit about how you found the book?
I'd be delighted to. You have to remember that I was in the eastern seaboard of the United States, nowhere near London, and I was plugging away at my scholarship on another London writer of the suburbs, Stevie Smith, and I started becoming very curious about the status of the suburb in the English imagination, because I'm a professor of English literature, and I discovered these Ramble books, and Gordon S. Maxwell is not alone. It turns out that there were many Ramble books where these enthusiastic writers were trying to direct their contemporary population to go explore the suburbs, and the fringe of London was one of the texts. It was in the New York Public Library, dusty, a little bit battered, but there and ready for reading by any scholar who happened to make in a request.
And could you tell us honestly what your first impression might have been? Because in this show, I should possibly pre-warn you, we will introduce this book as being something of almost religious status. Nick, what would you want to say about that? You said something to me in the cafe before we came on air.
Well, we consider it to be practically a holy book, and the first copy of the book that I ever possessed, I threw into the River Brent at its confluence with the Lidding Brook, close to one of the sites that are covered in the fringe of London, as a votive offering to some type of ill-defined landscape god.
Well, I wasn't able to anything such so ritualistic with my copy, because it was not my property. But I can tell you about something similar. To fetch this book out of the archives of the New York Public Library, which is that huge structure on 42nd Street in Manhattan with the big lion standing outside, and as a scholar, you go in there and you get your special cards, and you can't actually access the books, and they have this kind of pneumatic tube system where they put little pink slips for book requests, and they get sucked away into the depths of the library. And then, lo and behold, what should come out but the fringe of London? So there's a kind of similar flow, perhaps, but no water and no ritual. And I have to confess, I did not think of it as a holy book. But I want to situate it in relationship to other similarly kind of, well, first of all, do you know the full, you must know the full subtitle of this.
It's actually the name of our radio show.
Do you have the full subtitle here?
The full subtitle. Well, actually, if you've got it to hand, I do have it. But if
it's remarkable. This is kind of 18th century pseudo prose style. It has this extended subtitle, "The Fringe of London, Unrambling Around the Outskirts of London and of the Unexpected Turns, Trials and Triumphs that Lie in the Path of the Wayfarer." So I can understand with that kind of prelude how it might become a holy book. So no other scholars, nobody else has discovered this.
You're the first, because we're not scholars at all by any well.
Well, you know what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to be very naughty in that article that you uncovered it in. Thank heavens for Google, I guess. But this, of course, is not your typical scholarly fare. And so what I was trying to do is understand the way that adventurers like Gordon Maxwell were trying to see themselves as Londoners at a time in the interwar period when the suburb was this kind of, challenging, kind of threatening area. The suburbanites were settling there. These housing estates were being developed, and all the highbrows, the intellectuals, were fearfully negative, terrified by this region. And then there were others who I don't want to call them lowbrows, but the popular writer like Maxwell is, there's a completely different kind of take on what is the suburb and what you're supposed to do there.
Do you have any similar tradition in the States of books dealing with the loss of perhaps wilderness with the development of suburbia?
That's a good question. I don't know of any similar kind of literature, because what I discovered was a whole kind of library shelf of ramble books. There's one called The Outer Circle: Rambles in Remote London by Thomas Burke, 1921. Where London Sleeps: Historical Journeying in the Suburbs by Walter George Bell, 1926.
Fine book with a good essay on Barnett Wells.
Well, I love the one by Thomas Burke. He actually gets lost in Sherrick Green on Armistice Day.
Yes, Sherrick Green down near Neasden. In fact, it's very close to the area we're covering today in the essay we've taken from The Fringe of London, which is a look at Monk's Park. Sherrick Green was actually on the Slade Brook, which flows into the River Brent just by Monk's Park.
Well, could I read you a little passage? This is not Maxwell. This is his, his competitor in the ramble book market. This is Thomas Burke. He writes, this is 21, Sherrick Green, London, and I had never heard of it. A corner of my own city, where men ate and slept and loved and hated, where tradesmen built bonny businesses, where babies were born, where children went to school and grew into men and women, and I knew not of it. Other remote suburbs I knew and loved, and he continues on from there.
Well, I know the feeling well, yes.
It's kind of extraordinary. So the residents of Sherrick Green become, it's not naming those kind of corners and the geography and the topography, which is what Maxwell does so well, but this kind of remote population that one might kind of confront in a dangerous way, the heart of darkness in outer London and how to navigate. But there's hope with these suburbanites, because if you give them the right ramble book and they wander around properly, you could turn them into a proper Londoner. And this is the kind of anxiety that you see registered all the time in these 1920s ramble books.
Thank you very, very much indeed for that, Professor Bloomer. We've got to leave it there, I'm afraid, because we're live on air in about 5 minutes, terrifyingly for us.
My best wishes with your project. I think it's absolutely fabulous, and I will renew my quest for the Bible of Gordon S. Maxwell's Fringe of London.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. And that was that interview. That's all we've got time for this week on Ventures and Adventures in Topography. Thank you very much to the wonderful Hayley LaPaine for her beautiful readings this week of Gordon S. Maxwell's The Fringe of London. This show will be repeated on Monday at 10 p.m. The podcasts are available on a Wednesday. And you can email us at deeplibrary@yahoo.com. Thank you very much.